and welcome to the Dot to Dot podcast, joining the dots on what makes you, you. With me, Fiona Murden, psychologist and author, and every other week, my co-host, sports psychologist, Lou Jones.
Hi, Lou.
Hey, Fi, how are you doing?
I'm all right, thanks. How are you?
Good. It's, I'm good. It's like halfway through summer holidays, so it's always a bit of a mission balancing work, childcare, life, that type of thing. But I think I'm doing all right so far.
That's good. I threw that out of the window last night. Just stayed right until 2 o'clock in the morning.
Nice.
Which felt very teenage, I might say.
Nice. It's important to indulge your inner teenager every so often.
Yeah. Yeah, it wasn't so teenage this morning when I woke up and my 8-year-old was like, what time do you get home?
Yeah. You don't need to know.
Yes, I'm setting a good example for you here. But anyway, it's kind of relevant to what we're going to talk about this today, isn't it? Because we're going to talk about something that Jeffrey Arnott, who's a psychologist, says, the three goals to becoming an adult. And actually, we decided to talk about this based on an article I found in Insider, which I thought was interesting. I actually speak about Jeffrey Arnott and this stage of life in Defining You, only a page about it. When we're talking about this stage of life, what we're saying is, when do you become an adult? And I personally don't feel like I have become an adult ever. And actually, the first book I started writing, which I never actually finished, was called Why We Are All Just Big Kids, which was really just indulging myself, to be honest.
Okay, but so what would you define as an adult?
Well, for a start, don't you have to feel like an adult to be an adult?
Well, not according to law. You just have to be a certain age.
That's very true. There's adulting, you know, there's behaviour. I mean, I guess as well, I'm slightly hypocritical in that mirror thinking is about role modelling, and I should be role modelling how to be an adult to my children, which I'm not doing when I stay out till 2 o'clock in the morning and get drunk.
Well, it depends on what you're trying to role model, doesn't it?
That's true.
But I do find it, even like when you sent me this article, I really enjoyed reading it and kind of learning a bit more about the emerging adult or emerging adulthood. But I guess it's, you know, you talk about what an adult is, and it comes down to, I guess for me, again, we come down to perceptions, right? Mm. And Jeffrey talked about three different areas, which means if we have those three things, we are an adult, and it happens around the age of in your 30s, right? Is that right? Is that what you take?
Are we being unfaithful to Russ by talking about Jeffrey?
Why? I think as long as we mention Russ in every podcast, we're generally okay.
We've mentioned him now, so that's okay. Okay, I think we're okay to talk about Jeffrey. Yeah, so Jeffrey talks about that, but you know, I'm obsessed by the brain and neuroscience. And what I find fascinating is, so Jeffrey did his research, which is really interesting, and I think we should talk about it. But neuroscientific research has backed up the fact that our brain continues to develop until we're 29. So between the ages of 18 and 29. And
that's the same for all genders?
Yeah.
Okay. But it's at different points at different times, isn't it?
And it'll be different. I think that will finish probably. Some people will get there sooner, some people will get there later. You know, we can all make our own opinions on when people have got there. And as I said, I don't think I've got there yet. But one of the core things that's developing in the brain at that time is the links between the prefrontal cortex, where there's executive control, and the emotional centers of the brain. So it's being able to, well, I hate the word control your emotions because I think it's about managing your emotions, but it's about learning more about your emotional life, your emotional world, and how to deal with your emotions, how to manage them. So if you think about the teenage boy racing around in a car, you know, there are a huge number of crashes, aren't there, teenage boys in cars. As they get into their 20s, that number decreases. And you could probably correlate that data and say, well, that's because their brains are developing that control of the emotion that comes with testosterone and wanting to go and show off and drive cars fast and all those sorts of things.
I mean, I would always talk about that in the language of emotional maturity.
Or emotional wisdom, as I like.
Wisdom, yes.
Because you're wise. I mean, you're wise. I'm talking about how you were wise before we came on. You're emotionally wise and you're just wise.
Probably more so for others than I am myself. But yes, it's when my big inner kid takes over. But thank you. I mean, it's quite interesting when you think about the three things that Jeffrey talks about of to find, like, the three goals to become an adult. One is taking responsibility of yourself. Two is making independent decisions. And three is becoming financially independent. And I'm curious to know, when we talk about emotional wisdom, do you think you need emotional wisdom to be able to do all those three? Or it is a separate thing, you can have all those three without emotional maturity and it's another area of development?
Yeah, I mean, there will, I imagine that there's overlap. They're not separate constructs, but they're not the same construct, if that makes sense. So if you think about...
Because taking responsibility for yourself, that's a huge one, in terms of being able to accept responsibilities and the consequences of your own actions, rather than blaming someone else or your parents parachuting in and then dealing with it. Someone else dealing with it, maybe your partner or your husband or your wife, always comes in and supports you in that.
And that one, I think it's really interesting. It is something that we would categorise under emotional intelligence or emotional wisdom. Therefore, it is related to that brain development. But you can also see how it's related to circumstances, because if you've got parents who always parachute in, they will do that potentially whether you want them to or not, whether you're emotionally mature or not. But it also will, to an extent...
Well, if you're emotionally mature, would you not then have the confidence to go, stop, I would like to do this myself, please?
Yes, but I agree. But would they
it's not... difficult with your parents.
but there's also the fact that it will delay your emotional intelligence potentially, because you're not having to learn how to take responsibility for your actions.
Yeah.
So a very emotionally aware or mature person would be able to do it in spite of their parents having always come in to try and take over. But, you know, like you say, you can think of a lot of people where it's an adult per se, someone in their 30s, 40s, 50s, 60s, who will turn to their partner and, you know, help, I'm stuck, help me, I don't want to take responsibility for this. And, you know, we see it, you see people like that. Or we see adults who are, we're talking about various people who ex-husbands, ex-wives, who you know, you look at and you think, have you ever taken any responsibility in your life? I think that's on that point. It's funny, going off at slight tangent. I was going through photos the other day.
And Matt, you seem to say that as though we stick to the topic all the time.
That's very true. So I'll tell you about my photos. So
let's do that.
These photos, and for some reason I put loads of other people's weddings, photos of them together. But it's just thought, so it'd be, here's Annie and Chris, here's Joe and Brian, here's, so all these people. And I was going through this pile and I was like holding them up to Chris going, divorced, divorced. Well, they're still together, divorced. And Chris, so at first he was saying, well, you know what the statistics are around separation, that makes sense. And then I'd carry on, he'd like, do you think our statistics in our friendship group are slightly different? I was like, I think it is, yes, I think it is. But the reason I'm saying that is I hear a lot of my friends, male and female, talking about their ex-partners. And often ex-partners don't appear to take responsibility for things. So there are a lot of adults out there who have had kids, who have grown up and still haven't actually grown up into being the first stage of adulthood.
I mean, it's just that when you're an ex, it's a very easy thing to be blamed or
blame
an ex. It's an easy way out, so you don't actually, because it's a it's a hard, uncomfortable place to be to take responsibility for certain actions that you you've chosen to go through to execute.
It is.
There are some harder situations that you can take responsibility for. I don't know, burning toast or something is much easier than getting divorced, right?
Well, actually, in that sense, maybe we don't have to properly adult until sort of midlife in some respects, because that responsibility might be, I take responsibility for, you know, crashing into a bollard with the front of my car, or I take responsibility for the fact that I didn't pay my rent on time, or those sorts of things, which are signs of moving into adulthood. But then those big things, those massive responsibilities, if I take responsibility for cheating on my partner, or I take responsibility for upsetting my kids, those are things that maybe take another level of emotional maturity and emotional wisdom, and people don't always have that.
What do people do to develop emotional wisdom, Thee?
Yeah.
Has someone written any stuff in any books about that?
I think there's one called Mirror Thinking about that. And there's a little bit in something called Defining You as well, second edition.
I've heard there's some really good books.
Yeah, there won't be any others coming out soon.
What does it say in the Mirror Thinking book? On developing how you develop emotional wisdom.
Mirror Thinking. So it's tiny, nuanced, iterative observations of other people.
Mm.
And it's that continual, and it's not switching down or switching off ever. So that's the tendency that we can have, whether we're younger or older. It's like we're not really listening, or we're not really understanding. It's deliberately putting ourselves into other people's shoes, for example. That doesn't mean you'll fully understand someone else's perspective, but you're constantly looking at things from other people's perspective rather than just your own. But within interactions that you're having with people, you're observing, you're picking up on the nuances, the tiny little iterations of behavior. And if you look at it, so that builds empathy, which is an element of emotional intelligence or emotional wisdom.
Does it matter what lens you're looking through when you're doing that observation?
Yeah, I think it has to be as far as possible. The other thing we've talked about quite a bit is that curious lens. It's the light, non-judgmental, observational. So I call it the Poirot or the Maigret, or, you know, Miss Marple, as I'd like to be when I'm in my 70s or 80s.
Yeah, what a woman.
Yeah, it's not judging. So you're not saying, I think I know how that person feels. When you're curious, you want to understand. So we never understand. We never fully understand how someone else is feeling or what they're going through. And the only way to do that is to continually be curious with that light touch. And sometimes that's not asking, it's just watching and listening. It can be quite invasive if you start around and asking people, how are you finding this? What do you feel? You know, people, especially in a business setting, people sort of cringe the moment you say, what do you feel?
Would you class people watching in observation? Because I do love sitting down at a coffee shop or a bar and just watching the world go by and watching people and their interactions. And
absolutely. And reading. And there's again, there's research that shows that if you read good sort of well-written literature, you see things through other people's eyes and you experience them through other people's eyes, and it actually helps to develop emotional intelligence. I mean, when I was on holiday, I read a book, and it wasn't a workbook, which is amazing. It was a brilliant book. It was called The Parisian, and it was written from the perspective of a Palestinian in starting around 1914, visiting France, living in France as a Palestinian, and then going back to Palestine and all the struggles that were happening there. I found it so interesting because my dad was in Aden in the 1960s, and I've heard a lot about the Wadi and the Arabs, and he took a load of photos and interacting with them, and lovely people. But you see it from the other side, and you see how people saw the English how they saw the French, how they saw them coming in to help, you know, wasn't necessarily at all helpful. And it was just fascinating to see it through a completely different lens. And that, you still have to be open-minded, because you could go into that and go, well, no, I mean, of course they're going to say that, they're X, Y, and Z. So I think the open-minded piece is really important as well.
Well, otherwise that lens narrows, isn't it?
But that's, I mean, empathy is one part of it, but the self-awareness is another part that we've talked a lot about as well, and that's a foundation to it. And that self-awareness isn't about introspection, or it's, again, we've spoken about how it's this light touch understanding of ourselves. It's a curiosity about how we're feeling, rather than why am I feeling like this? Why? Because that's just going to get us going in circles and spinning, which, of course, that's what I was doing before we went on holiday. You know, it's again another example of me being able to talk about these things, but not necessarily do them.
So, okay, so in terms of emotional wisdom, it's about kind of observing others, putting ourselves in other people's shoes, reading some more books to kind of see, you know, being able to see the world through other people's eyes, and then increasing our own self-awareness. Anything else? Have we missed anything else?
Well, I mean, so something else that I've become really involved with, which you can see how it builds the social and emotional learning, is mentoring. So it's a very explicit way of doing it. It's very, you can give it a name, and we actually have mentors all the time without calling them mentors, and we are mentees all the time. But that relationship, if you're being a proper mentor to someone, you are developing yourself at the same time, because you're learning, you're seeing things, you're observing things, you're helping someone understand the world, but in a way that's going to help them rather than it's going to help you. So the one example I give there is, I mean, you or I could be guilty of it too, is a guy is headhunted for a CEO role. So he's been an ops director at a company, and he's always wanted to be, you know, MD or CEO. It's a great role. I, as a coach, get really excited. I'm like, yeah, that's brilliant. You should go for it. And I sort of encourage and cajole. But actually, if I stop and I talk to him and I explore how he's feeling about it, it's not the right time, because he's just had a baby with his wife. He doesn't want to be disappearing off. And this is going to be pretty full on for the next few years if he does it. And so it's really important to say, like, I'm going to put my motivations aside here. Even if I feel like my motivations are good and they're the right motivations for you, I'm going to put them aside. And actually, even the process of doing that helps you to build your emotional wisdom. But then the interaction you have with that person and understanding and getting underneath and guiding is, again, it's helping you with yourself and learning how to handle situations and understand the world. And so many people say when they like mentor kids, they learn stuff, and you do, because they see things differently, and we're learning about how a different generation sees things potentially. So it's an option as a way of doing it.
So it's having experiences that allow you to build on those skills of self-awareness and empathy. I mean, I think that's a hard skill in terms of being able to put your own motivations or biases goals to one side and go totally to where that person is. I mean, I know, and I don't know about you, but as a psychologist, you know, every so often I'm thinking, is that a question that I want to ask because I'm interested? And is the interest for their benefit or for my benefit? Why would I want, is that going to help them? And every so often, you know, certain questions come to my head like that to make sure that those parts are to one side while I actually deliver the piece of work and work with an athlete or client. So, but that is quite a high level skill, isn't it?
It is. And again, I'm sure it's, can you read what I'm thinking? People are less like that now. I think they understand psychology a bit more, but you know what I'm thinking, or you know who I am, or are you analyzing me? You're a psychologist. Are you analyzing me? Tell me what you think. And my response is no, because I'm not working. And so, yes, I'd be analysing as in the same way as anyone else would analyse someone else. And maybe through the skills that we acquire through a slightly different lens. But to actually profile someone or to coach or to help is it requires you to take a conscious step away from your own emotions, which takes huge effort. It's really interesting. It's really rewarding. But it's like, you know, you can't run all the time in exercise. You have to jog and walk and stop sometimes. And it's the same. You can't be in that mode all of the time because it does take concerted effort. Basically, you're operating with your observing brain, as I call it, or the frontal lobe of your brain, which is a lot slower and a lot more effortful to use than our emotional centers of the brain. But whilst doing that, you are building that connection. Another thing that came to mind when you were talking just then is the obvious one, which I haven't said and you haven't said, and that's not to say, oh, you haven't said it. I'm just digging a hole here. is meditation and mindfulness, which people do struggle with because it's effortful as well if you do it properly. So if you use something like Headspace, you know, I'm a massive fan of Headspace. I think the way Andy Pudicombe does it is really good because you're not only meditating, but he's training you how to deal with your thoughts and emotions at the same time. And whilst you're doing that, there's evidence again. There are loads of brain scans to show that improves, that strengthens the connectivity between the prefrontal cortex and the emotional centers of the brain.
Okay, so lots of ideas on how to improve our emotional maturity, which would take us into step one or number one of taking responsibility for ourselves, right?
Yeah, I didn't expect it to take that turn on conversation.
I never know what to expect from these podcasts. The second point is making independent decisions. So that's decisions about career, job, where you live, who you live with, what relationships you're in or not in, do you not want to be in them, because that's another decision. Those types of things. Those things take emotional maturity as well.
It's very true. They do take emotional maturity, but you can also see how I know friends who are in their 40s who still want to know what all their friends think about something before they make a decision, or their husband or wife, or even parents. People are still thinking, what would my mum think? What would my dad think? And that reference point can remain with you almost throughout life, I think, when it comes to what would mum think? What would dad think?
Yeah. Do you have those? I'm just trying to resonate with any of that.
No, I don't. But I do. So I didn't. Until my early 30s, think, what would my mum think? What would my dad think? It wouldn't necessarily change my decision, but it would always be weighing on me if I was in a relationship with someone that I didn't think my mum or dad approved of. Well, my dad never disapproved of anyone. There were people that my mum, for the right reasons, I guess, she could see that I was going to get hurt or whatever, would think that I shouldn't be in a relationship with. I remember being in one relationship. Mum really wanted me to marry this guy and I didn't want to. And she was like, he'd be perfect. I'm like, maybe for you, but not me. And so I guess I was making some level of independent decision. But there are times even when I think, oh, I wonder what Chris thinks of this. Do you think Chris thinks this is all right? And I want to sort of check in with him. But I guess to an extent, that's more partly being part of a couple as well.
Yeah.
What are your thoughts?
Well, my thoughts are, I think that may be making independent decisions, that the experience of that starts earlier on than probably taking responsibility for yourself. I guess it depends on everybody's situation. Yeah. But you'll start making independent decisions, I guess, about, am I going to let my mum put this horrible bit of food in my mouth? No.
Yes, very true.
Unless you call that, I don't know whether you call that an independent decision. You know, I see my 10-year-old and 12-year-old making independent decisions now. You know, not about career or job, although they'll talk about what they want to do when they're older, or where they live or location. you know, they're making decisions about potentially who to be friends with and who not to be friends with. Maybe who to be a boyfriend with and who not, or a girlfriend and who not. Or, you know, they see other people making decisions like that as well and wonder whether they should be making decisions about that. And I think so that, you know, are there things we need to be mindful of as parents helping pre-emerging adults to develop some of these skills?
I think it's very true, and I think you can strip that away, particularly with COVID, because teenagers are not doing what they might normally do, which might be, by now Libby might be getting a train up to London with her friends at 14, but possibly because she hasn't even been leaving the house much. Well, she has, because she's quite sociable, but she'll be walking with people outside. So, but it sort of slowed down that process potentially, which is a massive thing, because like you say, it's helping them learn to make those independent decisions. And I think, I mean, I think Arna might be referring, he describes it in terms of identity. And I think some of the things you're talking about there do relate to identity quite strongly. So you see a lot of teenagers or preteens even now transitioning. You see just more decisions being made about sexuality and things earlier on, I think, which are independent decisions. But the career one's interesting because a huge amount of research suggests that we are massively dependent, more so than we realise, on our parents for making decisions around our career. And I think as parents, it's important to take that observational stance and to curiously guide rather than to put our own, well, you know, I wanted to be a doctor, therefore you should be a doctor. Or I would be really, really proud if you went to Cambridge or Oxford, but what's right for your child? And I think we're aware of that, but it's making it really conscious and really helping them to make their own decisions around that and support them on that. Not just becoming adults, but to doing what's really, really best for them rather than us.
Yeah. Again, that's hard too, right? Because that's that skill again about putting yourself to one side and focusing on your children to say what's best for you.
Mm-hmm. And then there's always this question, isn't there? Because Chris and I have always been non-pushy around tests and things, but it's coming up to GCSE, so we're more encouraging around revising and doing those sorts of things, and more important now for Libby. But then I think, should we have been doing this before? Should we have been a bit more pushy? Should we have been a bit more concerned about test results? Because in the reality of the world, she will have to get good grades if she wants doors to open. That doesn't mean want her to go and study at Oxford or Cambridge. But, I mean, Libby wants to be an interior designer. It's important that she gets the grades that enable her to make that choice. But then later on, if she changes her mind, the grades that enable her to change her mind and do something else. But then this makes me cross, because it comes down to what society is expecting or, you know, pushing on children is these GCSE A levels, and they're not right for everyone.
No, I would agree with that. I would agree with that. I'm going to go on to number three.
Yes, do.
Number three is becoming financially independent.
And again, interesting from the perspective of teenagers that are more financially independent. So teenagers that earn tend to do better off later in life, simply because, I mean, based on what you'd say from Arnott's stuff, they're building those foundations much earlier on.
Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah. And they understand the work is needed to get the money, the reward, how it feels to have the money. And actually, it's quite interesting. I was talking to an athlete the other day, and they were saying that they finished school at the age of 16. And actually, in the last year when he was doing GCSEs, he ended up actually working instead, because in his head, why was he in a classroom learning when he could be outside earning and a bit more, it was more interesting. So I thought his viewpoint on that was quite refreshing, when he just felt he was doing nothing in the classroom, but he wanted to be doing something. So why not just go out and actually work?
There's one stat that said 90% of our learning is through social means. So he was probably learning more in the work environment, both in terms of his social and emotional skills, but also in terms of his functional or technical skills that
sitting in a classroom, you're not getting, or you're getting information that's not. I mean, I remember I always used to think, why do we have to learn how to do this pure math stuff? Because when are we ever going to use it in life?
There are some careers that need that level of detail in their maths, isn't it?
There are, but then, you know, they're not all careers, are they? So
no. I certainly haven't used any of that in my life since.
Yeah, I mean, but with us, we've had to. I'm sure you had to do advanced stats on your MSc, and so there is coming back to it, and it is actually useful in terms of behavioural settings for research and medical settings because there are so many inputs. But that's stats. That's not pure maths. I don't get why people need to use pure maths. Okay, I do. It's used for some careers, but still pure maths.
So one of the other things that Geoffrey says is actually patience is really important in all areas of this, to allow individuals to get to that point around the age of 30 to develop these, to have these three things in place to become an adult.
Yeah, and I was listening to a podcast with Barack Obama. It was really good. And Dax Shepherd and Monica, and I can't remember her surname, but it's called The Armchair Expert. And Dax is so funny. He kept coming back to the question of, but did you look for father figures in your friends because you didn't have a father growing up? Because I did. And Barack would go off and talk about something else. You go, well, I'm going to ask again. Did you look? it was a lovely, really lovely interview. But one thing that, well, a few things, I mean, many things that he said that were interesting, but one thing he said was when he was studying in his early 20s, he partied, he went out, and then he got to the point where he wanted to study, and he actually moved universities because the group of people knew him as someone who partied and who went out, and they couldn't understand why he was suddenly studying. And so he had to almost take himself to a different environment to be able to do that, to start again and
create the identity that allowed him to be how he wanted to be.
And he then goes on to say how it's interesting when you look at people in their 20s, people do develop at different rates. So some people will buckle down and start taking life a bit more seriously when they're 20. They'll say, right, I need to study, I need to do this. Whereas other people will still be partying like mad when they're 29. And of course, we know people that carry on beyond that. But you do see that in that decade, there's a huge variation in when people stop doing this and start doing this. Because I remember at university, some friends getting married. And I was like, what are you doing? How can you get married in your early 20s? But that was right for them. I was way off that in terms of emotional maturity. So if you think back to your own life in that period, you probably can see those differences amongst friendships.
And do you think that was my next question in terms of, you know, between the 20s and 30s, when you are going through that development of these areas, and the people that you hang out with, or the maybe the people that you fall out with, are they is it normally because they're at different points of that development? So actually your emotional maturity might be very different to someone else's, and therefore you don't build a particularly strong relationship with them, and then actually but in a couple of years time you might be on the same level, and then you end up connecting in a more effective way.
I think that's so true. I mean, I don't know about you, but I can think of a few friends where that's happened. It's not that we've fallen out, we've maybe just had different interests at different times, and then as the rhythm of life has settled down, we've become closer again.
So from 30-ish onwards, it becomes a bit more stable. If people, I mean, is there a point where, say, by 30 or ish, if you haven't got these three things in place, you'll never get them, and therefore you'll never be an adult?
I don't think so, do you? I mean, actually, I'm thinking about 30.
There are definitely people I find in my world that don't have these things, and I can't imagine them ever having them.
Well, I think sometimes it takes a life event for someone that's gone through, like, maybe beyond 30, 40, to be shaken a bit and see the world from a different perspective, and that doesn't always happen. So people can actually become worse with age, can't they? I mean, I look at it, I just think about myself. I'm definitely financially independent when I was paying my own phone bill from when I was 13 through money I'd earned doing jobs and sort of babysitting and stuff like that. So I was comfortable with that. But I mean, I remember my 30th birthday. I know it was a long time ago, but I do remember it. And sat with a table of my friends trying to make an excuse as to why I wasn't drinking because I was pregnant. And I sat at one end with my uni friends and they all go, who do you think's going to have a baby first? Who do you think, who's it going to be? And I'm sat there thinking, me, because I'm pregnant. And but it really freaked me out. And I don't mean to seem ungrateful because I'm so happy that I had Libby. But when I got pregnant, I was like, oh my God, I'm 30. I didn't expect this to happen so quickly. And there was that panic of, I don't know if it fits into any of Arnott's things, but it was pure panic. I am not grown up enough to have a child. I'm not ready for this.
Okay, so let me ask you now, do you feel ready now to have kids?
Yeah, I do. But I still find it surprising that I have a teenager. That's partly because she's taller than me. She's wiser in many ways than I am. She's got far better dress sense, so I'm always checking in on her before I leave the house. What does this look like? it's weird, isn't it? But no, I do feel, I don't know about you, but I do feel settled into being, I love being a parent. I feel very privileged to be a parent. I don't think I've got it right, but then I don't think any of us get it right all the time. But
I think if you're thinking you haven't got it right, then that's parenting, isn't it?
Mm.
I think if you think you've got it all right, then you haven't.
But, you know, he talks about...
Well, that's just me dealing with my own parenting skills.
I know, I think you're totally right, Lou. I think we should be questioning and examining what we're doing all the time. It's that sort of that light observation, though. It's not doing it in the way that we're going, oh, my God, I'm an awful parent. It's in a way that you say, how could I do this differently? How could I do it? It's constantly asking yourself that question. But if we go back to Arnott's, you know, it's a quest for finding identity is making independent decisions is about a quest for finding identity partially. And it really shook me having a baby. It didn't fit my identity. I was not ready. I would walk around thinking, this is strange. I've got a pram. I mean, you'd think by 30 I was ready, but... And I think that's a huge, huge topic that maybe if people are interested, we cover sometime. And that's, it's identity both as a mother and a father after you've had a child. How does it...
Well, I was about, there's the other transition, isn't it? Like in terms of if you don't feel it's part of your identity, have a kid, it will take you by surprise, right? And then when you might have got to the point where you're at where, you know, it's part of your identity now and you're thoroughly enjoying it, and then they leave the home.
Yeah, and I think that's why I think that's very difficult, the empty nest a bit.
You know, how ready are I for that? You know, I think it's quite interesting. So there's definitely, you know, and I see some parents out there who have just fully, they are the mum or the dad, they are fully that. And I've often wanted, you know, I thought that would be great to be like that. I'd be such a good parent. But I don't think I'm not a, you know, I don't know what to call it, a mumsy mum. And that's not to say that those, you know, I would like to be more like that, but that's just not the way I am. But I can imagine people who are a bit more like that might find that transition a bit more tricky. I mean, I have no idea how I'm going to find it. I'm not looking forward to it because I thoroughly love it at the moment and have two fantastically awesome girls. We will see.
And I think it's a really good point. And there's a book by a lady, she's died now. I saw her on an interview the other day and I thought, I recognise that name. And I've got her books called Passages. And it talks about the transitions that we make through life. And there is a shift in trying to recalibrate our identity at different stages in life. And that empty nesting is one of them. Midlife is one of them. Actually, that's what they were talking about. It was a documentary talking about the guy that did, that car that's on Back to the Future.
Yeah. I know what you mean.
DeLorean. No, the DeLorean. DeLorean, yes. So it was talking about the guy, DeLorean, who created this, and then he ended up getting put in prison for drug trafficking because he was so desperate to make money. Long story, but she'd been studying him at the time of writing that, and he was about 47 when he left General Motors and started creating the DeLorean, which is his name. Yes, so.
Summary time. Oh, yes, my summary. Summary time. So we have talked about Jeffrey Arnott's article on three goals to become an adult, taking responsibility for yourself, making independent decisions and becoming financially independent. And I think there are some key themes around that, or some foundational skills for that being emotional maturity, which would involve enhancing your empathy skills and your self-awareness. And actually just some really interesting discussions and thought-provoking things come out that, and it's always worth resonating with ourselves on actually where we're at with that. But I would also say to people, no matter how much adulting you do, it's really important to just get your inner kid out.
I agree.
Play.
And do you know the people I was out with last night? Do you know what their company's called? Play. Yeah.
There you go.
So that's the whole value system and the ethos of how they basically create tech which enables people to improve health, well-being, all those sorts of things through play.
Yeah, love it.
But they were just talking
so important.
When I got there yesterday afternoon, the meeting, there were four guys sat there playing Mario Kart on a big screen. I was like, can I play?
Awesome, yeah. Brilliant.
Yeah. Anyway. Fabulous, as always, chatting to you. Thank you, everyone, for listening. If you want to connect with us, the details are in the show notes. If you do like what we witter on about, please do rate it and tell your friends about it, because we're hoping to just spread a bit more information and a bit more love when it comes to behaviour, you, us, the world.
Yeah, thanks, V.
Thanks, Lou. Bye.
Bye.
Thanks to my guests, thanks to you for listening. If you want to find out more about me and my work, go to fionamurden.com, or my social media handle is also Fiona Murden. If you enjoyed this, please do subscribe, review and tell your friends. It'd be a massive help. But for now, goodbye, and I hope you have a great week.